Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulippe. I'll be talking with Susie Damolano, the star of the new production of Tiny Beautiful Things at SF Playhouse, based on the Academy Award and Golden Globe nominated writer and actress Nina Vardalos' book. Oh, it's based on the book by Cheryl Strayed, Tiny Beautiful Things. We'll hear more about that from Susie. We'll also continue our love fest with San Francisco Playhouse with award-winning playwright Rogelio Martinez and actor Griffin O'Connor about the Playhouse's production of Born in East Berlin, about the 1988 Bruce Springsteen concert in East Germany where 300,000 people showed up. I'll talk with multi-talented writers, dancers, choreographers, and sisters, Megan and Shannon Korashige, about their play for dance titled Just Ahead is Darkness at Z-Space. And Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, talks with dramaturg Philippa Kelly about her new book, Diversity, Inclusion, and Representation in Contemporary Dramaturgy, and about upcoming productions at Cal Shakes in Orinda. Stay with us. Now through March 7th, you can enjoy San Francisco Playhouse's Bay Area premiere of Tiny Beautiful Things, based on the book by Cheryl Strayed and adapted for the stage by Nina Vardalos. It's directed by Bill English and stars my guest, Susie Damolano. Susie is Sugar, the co-founder with her husband, Bill English, who is the director, and she's also the producing director of SF Playhouse. She's a five-time recipient of the San Francisco Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Excellence and Theater Award for Principal Actress in a Play, five times. And she's directed and been in leading roles in a number of other productions at the Playhouse and elsewhere. Susie, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
And congratulations on a really emotionally wrenching night after night, it must be for you, but really fantastic performance.
Thank you. Thank you.
Did you know about this Dear Sugar column before Nina Vardalos' adaptation of Cheryl Strayed's book?
No, I did not. But the first thing that I did when Bill told me about it is I downloaded the Audible book of Tiny Beautiful Things, which is a book about with all the letters in it, and the letters are much longer than they are in the play. And the great thing about the Audible book is that Cheryl Strayed is reading it herself. Mm. So you become best friends with her immediately.
Uh-huh. And your own experience with advice columnists? Have you always been? You always turned to Dear Abby first, or Miss Manners, or?
You know what's funny is in high school, I used to read the Sunday paper sitting next to my dad, and I always got the Ann Landers articles from him, and I would scan them to see if there was anything written by like a 13 or 14 year old, and see what she said.
I always scan for the racy parts. And
exactly.
And how about Miss Manners or sort of columns?
Yeah, you know, back in the day, now I don't look at them. But I think the interesting thing about Dear Sugar is it's so completely different than any of those, because the articles like Miss Manners and Ann Landers, they're trying to tell you how to live your life or what to do to be proper, where Sugar is really just sharing her own experiences to people who are looking for advice. And rather than telling them what to do, she's just telling everybody they're okay.
Mm-hmm. And you're sharing as Sugar part of her experiences rather than just giving advice.
It's exactly
interesting pretense.
Exactly. And yeah, what a life Cheryl has lived.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's, I mean, if you wrote that in fiction, nobody would believe you. So it's pretty amazing that it's nonfiction.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Cheryl's life and how it works into the play.
Yeah, well, she's had a Well, I don't know if she would say she had a rough life. She's just had a lot of life experience, and she's found a way to work her way through it, starting with a horrible childhood with a dad that left her and a horrible grandfather on her father's side. And then she lost her mother when she was only 22. And from that point, she turned over to a few months of heroin use. And I think just living a wild life. Speaking of wild, she wrote wild because right. She did the hike across the Pacific Coast Trail.
That was crazy. I read that book. It's like, what was she thinking?
Yeah. I mean, I'm scared to sleep outside camping for 2 nights. I can't imagine hiking where there's no other people. Right. So she's an incredibly brave person that just seems to work through fears and work through hard things, just seemingly to have a belief in good things will come of it.
Mm-hmm. So this play is featuring three letter writers. Let's talk about them.
Well, it's featuring their character names are letter writer number one, number two, and number three. But they represent many letter writers. And what's amazing about the three actors playing that is how they're able to embody in just a few words sometimes completely different characters. Like the men play women, the woman plays men, they play eighth graders, they play old people. They're just all over the place. And I'm so in awe of them every night, just watching them go through the different emotions and stories for each of the characters. My job is relatively easy. I stay Dear Sugar.
right. Well, let's give a shout out to them now. Mark Anderson Phillips as letter writer number one, Kina Cantor
mm-hmm.
as letter writer number two, and number three is Jomar Tagatek.
Yeah. Yes. Brilliant actors, all three, and such nice people to work with. I do most of the talking in the play and had a little struggle getting all the words crammed into my brain. And those three were nothing but generous with me.
It is a lot of work. I mean, you are on that stage all the time for the entire play.
Yeah.
And we mentioned that it's an emotionally wrenching experience. Do you have to compartmentalize that now that you've gotten it down?
Actually, now that I have it down, well, working on it and learning it, you really have to imagine it as your own life. And the interesting thing is now that I have it inside, I don't find it as emotionally wrenching. It's really just sharing my story. It's no different than if I told you a personal story about myself right now. So I don't think it's compartmentalized. It just becomes a part of you. So it's not as hard to carry around. And plus, it's such a gift to be able to say her words and live her life, because she is such a beautiful person and has such a great outlook on life that I really feel like I'm becoming a better person by playing Cheryl Strayed.
Interesting. Can you share with us a little bit of what sort of advice or how Dear Sugar relates to people from the play?
Well, I'll tell you how one of the lines that really resonates with me is she talks to one of the characters who is a father who lost his son because a drunk driver hit him. And one of the things that she says to him is how when her son was 6 years old, he just very innocently said, people die at all ages. And it made her realize or accept in a very small way that her mother's life was 45 years long and that there was nothing beyond that. And for me personally, about 2 months ago, I lost a cousin who is basically like my baby sister. She's 5 years younger than me, and she just passed away in her sleep. And yeah, very shocking and horrible. And I hold on to that idea that perhaps her life was just like Cheryl's mother. It was 45 years long, and there was nothing beyond that. She was intended to be here just for that. And there's something There's something healing about
cathartic,
that.
Cathartic, yeah.
So, yeah.
Much so. This is being directed by your husband. What is that experience like? You've been under his whip before. So
yeah. Yes, yes. I think he gets me back for being under my whip. It was an incredible experience. I think we've been doing it for, well, we've been married for 20 years, and he's directed me a lot. And through the years, we've...
And vice versa.
I mean. And vice versa. Me, him more than, because he hasn't been acting lately.
Right.
But early on, years ago, we made a rule that he doesn't get to give me notes anymore from once we get to bed.
That's wise.
Yeah, yeah. And he inserted a caveat, unless I ask a question. So this, I think doing this show and just all of the, you know, the bareness that you have to have in your soul, it was really nice to have my husband directing it because I was in a very safe place, somebody that knows me really well and could just encourage me to go further with it.
Mm-hmm. What was an aha moment that he offered you that you hadn't thought about in your character or your approach to the staging of it?
The aha was initially I was really trying to show all the emotions she was going to. And the aha was him saying, you've got this, just say it because it's already there and be really simple with it. And by being simple with it, it allowed things to flow. And I think that's what's amazing about the show is the ebb and flow of the emotions, that some nights certain things will hit you and other nights other things will hit you. And same with the audiences.
Mm. Based on Cheryl Strayed's book, Tiny Beautiful Things, a stage adaptation by Nia Vardalos, starring Susie Damalama, directed by her husband, Bill English, co-founders of The Playhouse, runs through March 7th, SF Playhouse, for more information. The Playhouse seems to be thriving. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And a lot of it is due to people like you coming and telling people about it. Thank you.
Well, it's a swell space, too. Give us a little bit of a preview of what's coming up. Obviously, later this hour, we're going to hear about Born in East Berlin.
Yes, because we have the main stage where we do 6 performances a year. And then we have our sandbox series of world premieres. And that we're presenting at the Creativity Theater in Yerba Buena Center. And it's so fun because you get the playwright who you're going to be speaking with, and he comes and he changes lines, and, you know, you get to ask him, why'd you write that? Or, you know, it's really fun. So mm-hmm. I think one of the actors is coming who may have a different point of view of changing lines and having to learn a new line every day.
Right.
But it makes it really, you're just part of the whole creation.
Mm-hmm. And further down the road for the season?
We will be doing Real Women Have Curves, which is on its 30-year anniversary. Some of you may have seen the movie way back when. And after that, we're going to do The Clean House. I'm directing it. And this summer, we're doing the musical of Follies, which will be the first professional presentation in San Francisco.
What?
Yeah. It can you believe it?
I can't. And I'm so looking forward to it. It's one of my favorite shows.
Oh, my God. It's going to be incredible. And Bill is directing that and going nuts with it. So something to look forward to.
Casting all settled for that?
Yes. Yes. We have Karen Ziembe, who's a Broadway star, coming to play one of the leads.
Nice.
Very exciting.
Excellent. All details at sfplayhouse.org. Susie Damalano, thanks for coming in, and let's have you back for your next directing
I'm
shot.
I'm in. Thank you.
Of course. As I mentioned, more to come from SF Playhouse. You'll hear about the production of Born in East Berlin, about the legendary concert performed by Bruce Springsteen in East Germany in 1988. That plus Philippa Kelly will be talking with Peter Robinson about Philippa's new book and her work with Cal Shakes. Stay with us here on Open Air. Thank you. Some of the beautiful music you'll hear in the production of Just Ahead is Darkness, a play for dance, that music by Corey Wright. This play for dance is devised for 6 performers and 4 musicians and draws on the Japanese and Japanese-American tradition of remembering the dead to tell a poignant and magical tale about family, love, loss, and the eternal return of ghosts. This play for dance was created by Sharp and Fine co-founders Megan and Shannon Kurashige, who joined me in studio. Sharp and Fine is a San Francisco-based contemporary dance company founded by the sisters in 2011 to create narrative performance work that brings together physically exuberant choreography, emotionally nuanced text, live music, and multidisciplinary collaborations. Sisters Megan and Shannon Kurashige, welcome to Open Air.
Hi.
Hello.
My first question has got to be collaborating as sisters. Now, did you always get along as sisters, or was that period of growing up where you couldn't be in the same room with each other without tripping each other or making each other crazy?
I feel like we've always gotten along pretty well. We're like 4.5 years apart in age, so mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty good.
Yeah, it's a decent spread where you're still close, but you don't have too much overlap in school, and no one's like, oh, I had your sister in my class last year, and you're not the same.
But right, I'm the youngest of 7, so I got that
so
a
you
lot.
Know. Yeah.
Other siblings in your family then?
No, just us.
Just you two. Mm-hmm. So when did you start realizing that you could create together?
We were working with another dance company that we perform with, and we had some time off, and we were feeling like we wanted to do something, and it just felt really natural to collaborate together and to get together a group of our dancer friends and a writer friend and just to try to make something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The description of Sharp and Fine is quite ambitious in terms of everything you're trying to involve. Let's talk specifically about how Just Ahead is Darkness came together and what is it based on?
So the piece was originally inspired by Obon dances, it's for the Japanese festival of Obon, which is to honor and remember your ancestors who have passed on. And in Hawaii, which is where our parents come from and where most of our extended family still lives, bone dances are a huge thing. Every summer, there's a season for it. Each Buddhist temple will have a festival, and there will be a ritual in which people will wash graves and visit their relatives and remember the dead. But at the end, there is always a celebration called a bone dance in which there's music and people dance in a circle and... it's really wonderful because it's not just for remembering and for the people who belong to that temple. Everyone is welcome. Tourists, non-Buddhist people,
teenagers,
old people, everyone is there. And it's this kind of poetic and beautiful celebration that is not precious in any way.
Yeah.
I think
it's like a super normal part of life for everyone to come together and dance,
yeah.
Which feels very unusual and magical in these days.
And,
you know?
And a celebration rather
yeah.
than a mourning.
Yeah, completely.
And so based on family members that you know or just stories that you know from your family?
The piece began with our sort of memories of going to bone dances and our family mm-hmm. and how we used to do that every summer. But we actually created the piece really closely with our collaborators, our dancer cast, and all of the words and the movement sort of grew out of material that we created together. And so there's things from like everyone's grandma and everyone's grandpa mm-hmm. and like just little fragments of memories.
They've sort of woven together. We've created a family.
Mm-hmm.
The piece is... follows the story of a family that the dancers and ourselves make up, and pieces of movement, the text, as Megan was saying, it's all pulled from the cast's collective recollections of their family and things that their parents used to do or that they did with their grandparents or it's always, because it's always really fruitful to come into a studio with your collaborators, and our collaborators are amazing. They're, I would not want to work with anyone else in the world. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of other people I'd be really excited to work with, but they're really special, and they give us so much trust, and they openly share so much. And so these little pieces of truth come together, and we create this new story for the family that we've made for the show. Mm. And it's really beautiful because it's, again, it's all true. Yeah. And it's all things that we couldn't come up with on our own. Mm-hmm. And so it feels bigger, which is really nice. Mm.
So speaking of family, let's talk about the Sharp and Fine family. Is this, are the performers people that you've worked with as a core before, or are there others that are new collaborations?
Our dancers, we have had long relationships with all of them who are in this show. Sarah Woods-Ledoux and Sonia Dale have worked with us on our last few shows. They're amazing. They really understand how we all work together and have pushed us to work in more exciting ways. And then Christian Burns and Tristan Ching Hartman were actually teachers that we had at the San Francisco Conservatory of Dance. And they have joined us as part of our cast. And it's been really interesting and exciting to work with people from a different generation of dance, mm-hmm. who are like our mentors and teachers. And it's very generous of them to come
to
and
trust us,
trust us as performers.
So tell us what we'll see visually on the stage.
There's a giant black staircase. There are these magical ghost trees. There's a whole family. Death is a mm-hmm. character. Someone portrays death. There's
and
a ghost.
There's a ghost. There's also a full band. So
yes.
As your listeners heard, Corey's music will be played live by a four-piece band composed of Steve Adams, Corey himself, John Schott, and Jordan Glenn.
Yeah, and they are amazing musicians, like absolutely brilliant, like full-hearted, great people and
yes.
artists. Mm.
Well, let's hear a little bit more of the music of Corey Wright, a commissioned score for this particular performance. Composer and Reeds player Corey Wright is a regular contributor on the Bay Area's vibrant jazz and new music scene. He's played with folks like Anthony Braxton, Vinnie Golia, Eddie Gale, Adam Rudolph, Yusef Lateef, among others. So here's some more music of Corey Wright. The track is called, I'm missing that somewhere.
I don't know.
It's
that
more music.
Yes.
Constellations, I think.
It's for a section called
yes.
Constellations.
All right, great. And thank you both for coming. And Megan and Shannon Kroshik, I wish you a wonderful performance. Are your parents going to be able to come to the performance?
Yes.
Yes.
Our parents will be there every night. And if you come on Friday, you can meet them. Our mother and aunties are throwing the reception to end all receptions. It's a
bone
dance inspired. So there will be Hawaii-style chow fun, fried rice. It'll be fun.
Which night is that?
Friday.
Opening okay.
night. So those shows are this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Z-Space.
Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 2 p.m. Z-Space is at 450 Florida Street here in San Francisco. Visit zspace.org/darkness for tickets and learn more about what they're doing at Sharp and Fine at sharpandfine.com. Thanks for coming in. music by Corey Wright, presented as part of Sharp and Fine's production of Just Ahead is Darkness, a play for dance by sisters and co-founders of Sharp and Fine, Megan and Shannon Kurashige. A very good afternoon to you. I'm David Latulip. You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Still to come, I'll be talking with Rogelio Martinez and actor Griffin O'Connor about another SF Playhouse production, Born in East Berlin, shortly. But it's always a pleasure to welcome our regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, here with good friend and incredible dramaturg or turge, depending on how you'd like to pronounce it, Philippa Kelly.
Hi, Philippa. Welcome, and good to have you back here at KLW. And I know, as a dramaturge, you are master or mistress of everything that happens at Cal Shakes. So let's kick off by talking about the upcoming summer season.
I'd love to tell you what's on our season, Peter. First off, Comedy of Errors, a very early play of Shakespeare's, directed by the wonderful Jessica Holt. And that play is really intriguing because it looks at dark human situations that refuse to be played out that way. You've got everything that's dark: spousal betrayal, husbands locked out of doors, accusations of adultery, beatings, family splitting up, and yet it turns out to be a hilarious, mismatched comedy. It takes place in the city of Ephesus in Turkey, separated from by two seas from Syracuse in Sicily. And one pair of twins travels to find its fraternal matches, the Antipholus, and then again the Dromio twins. Each pair is searching for the other. They've been born on the same day, but separated by a storm.
So it's a dysfunctional family with a happy ending, is that right?
Well, each twin is left for years to imagine the other half. But when they find those others, it's not a glorious reunion, but a ridiculous misrecognition. And what I love is that the play reminds us very much of the way we often find ourselves treating someone not as who they think they are, but who we think they are.
So it's kind of reverse psychology, a bit of mind reading and a bit of assumptions, and probably we're wrong.
Yeah, well, but yet, in some ways, turn out to be right. Then we've got The Oresteia, Ellen McLaughlin's wonderful translation of Aeschylus's play about family revenge, or the legacies passed down from parents to children, and what we are because of them. Then we've got the world premiere of 1001 Nights, and that's part of our New Classics Initiative. It's a retelling by Leila Buck and Evren Otsikin, and actually directed by Evren. And that's inspired by the Middle East folk tales of 1001 Nights, told by Scheherazade, about the battle to save a kingdom and all the women in it. And then our final play is a bilingual Romeo and Juliet. It's an adaptation by Karen Zacharias, and it's called Romeo e Juliet. And I think what's fascinating for us as we plan it is that we might use the bilingual nature of it to create misunderstandings in language in place of Shakespeare's plethora of misused letters.
So does that mean that one actor could be speaking in English, asking a question in English,
and replied to in Spanish?
Mm-hmm.
But what's fascinating is that we use these mix of languages to represent, I think, the misunderstandings that warp and deform a society that's often riven by bigotries.
Mm-hmm. So in different ways, if we were to put it in a contemporary scene, we start with a family in Comedy of Errors. We move into a wholly different area with the Scheherazade tale.
Oresteia, second. And then 1001 Nights,
mm-hmm.
and then Romeo and Juliet.
Now I think, you know, probably for everyday listeners, as a dramaturge, you're having to put all these different plays in a context. You're having to explain them to the audience. You're having to probably explain them to the actors, also confer with the director. So a dramaturge is what I call a woman for all seasons in this case. And I just admire the fact that you actually have a book coming out in April, which covers this full range. So tell us a little bit about what we'd find in your upcoming book.
Oh, thanks, Peter. Well, I think theatre has always been about democracy, about how we live in the world as social creatures. What does it feel like to be dethroned from the universe? That's my eternal obsession with King Lear. What does it feel like to be abandoned, snubbed, shamed, beloved by someone you don't want, or to love someone who doesn't love you? And do things like forgiveness mean compromise? I think that every human situation is familiar in some way to anyone who's lived on the earth. But so often we're so busy engaging in the moment that we don't get the opportunity to look at it, especially from perspectives that are not our own. And I think that now is a really exciting time for theatre because young people, people of colour, people of age who might be deemed irrelevant, people of other abilities, are interested in ways that theatre can explore democracy and social justice, not to have questions answered, but to have them, as I see it, illuminated, to shine a light on them in different ways.
So if we look at the book, I mean, obviously that's a big theme, how to explore unanswered questions and how to put the question out there for the audience to at least grapple with. And we looked at some of the chapters in this particular book. What would be examples of different chapters that you're applying this philosophy?
So when Amrita Ramanan from OSF and I were planning who would actually be invited to write these case studies, we wanted to choose people who could actually come from ways of thinking and dramaturging that would be sometimes unfamiliar, sometimes familiar, but not a path easily trodden by other dramaturgs. So we chose people who work in the theatre with autism and who have autism as what people have always designated their disability, and they think about it in different ways. African-American identities. We've got a piece about Korean text, Chinese, the idea of naming and the way a name often really curates a lot about a person and their expectations and how this feeds into gender.
So I think in terms of just diversity, if I was to take any six headings, you've already hit five of them already. What about a play, for example, that opens and a person is in a wheelchair and the wheelchair is pushed onto the stage and the actor opens an expression that applies to that situation? How does that relate to being a dramaturge?
Well, I think it's funny. There's actually a play at ACT right now, Wakey Wakey, whose protagonist is in a wheelchair. So the first thing that you ask is, oh, what is the wheelchair? Am I supposed to see it or not? And so that question will be practically answered within the production. But where the questions in theatre, I think, really can help you to, in a way, shine your own light on darker places within yourself is when they provoke you to look at yourself and what you see in different ways.
Now, let's assume the person in the wheelchair has a deep sense of humour and his opening line is, don't get around much anymore. What does that tell the audience?
Well, again, that's a question that you're going to find an answer for. Which may or may not be offensive to you or to others. What I think about humour is that it is at its most powerful when it is managed by the very person who is the butt of the humour. I think that it can be very degrading otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So The book, which has a subtitle, and I think you should tell us the subtitle of the book because it's a sentence, but let's hear it.
Well, I wish you hadn't asked me that because it sounds so so scholarly that everybody will think, oh my goodness, I don't want to download that. It's called Diversity, Equity and Representation in Dramaturgy, Case Studies from the Field.
Well, I think the great thing about it, it is based on case studies. So
yes.
what we're actually hearing are people giving voice to their own experience.
Yes. And what was really wonderful editing these is every single essay became a multi-pronged conversation between myself and the author as we each piece sort of I felt that it was in a garden where they blossomed and became really unexpectedly interesting to each of us, the writer and myself, in ways we hadn't expected.
Mm-hmm. And I think one earlier book by you, which I really enjoyed, was called The King and I, which wasn't based on the musical, but it was in fact based on King Lear, but also based on your own interrelationship with your father as well.
Yeah, and Australia, it's been called by one reviewer as Dramaturg in King Lear for Australia. But that book was very based on looking at issues of social justice through the window of King Lear. In fact, actually, the press just wrote to me yesterday, some people still are looking to buy it, but there's only hard copies on Amazon, so they're going to actually put out a downloadable, printable version for a small price.
Oh, good, good, good. So just to recap, if you want to give us the titles of the upcoming Cow Shakes season one more time.
Yes, Comedy of Errors, Oresteia, Thousand and One Nights, and Romeo y Juliet. And I will be there in the Grove many, many nights to welcome you.
And I should explain that one of the great things about going out to Orinda is you can pack a lunch, have a nice picnic table, and then out of nowhere comes the beautiful Philippa. And you're sitting there in the Grove, ears open, and you get a breakdown on the play. You get a quick synopsis as to what to look for, how the play got written, and what were the ways they constructed their interpretation.
So, myself or one of the other wonderful speakers. So it won't always be me, but it'll be somebody very intriguing. And it's actually lovely to come a couple of nights and hear completely different takes on the play.
They have their exits and they have their entrances. And today our entrance was with Philippa Kelly. Thank you for coming in. And we wish you a fun and exciting season at California Shakespeare.
Thank you, Peter.
That, of course, is the legendary Boss, Bruce Springsteen, and Born in the USA. Well, back in 1988, Bruce Springsteen played a legendary concert in East Germany, and some 300,000 people showed up. It's the subject of the play Born in East Berlin, which explores the ultimate juxtaposition between the freedom of a rock concert and the captivity of an impressive government during a time of great historical and cultural shift. Born in East Berlin was written by my guest, Rogelio Martinez. Rogelio is an award-winning playwright whose plays has been workshopped and produced in theaters around the country and abroad. His newest play, Blind Date, was produced at the Goodman Theater and starred Tony Award-winning actress Deanna Dunnigan as Nancy Reagan. Born in East Berlin, will be workshopped by English Theatre Berlin in collaboration with the Stasi Museum and will commemorate the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Among Rogelio's honors, a 2017 Guggenheim Fellowship, a Princess Grace Award, and a mid-career fellowship at the Lark Theatre Company. In addition, he's written for children's television and teaches playwriting at Columbia University and at NYU. Martinez has translated the work of both Mexican and Cuban playwrights, was born in Sancti Spiritus, Cuba, and came to this country on the Mariel Boatlift in 1980. Welcome to you, Rogelio.
Thank you.
Of course. And he was joined by actor Griffin O'Connor, who plays Gerhard in the production and also joins me in studio. Griffin is an actor, occasional mover, I understand, and sometimes singer, based in San Francisco, born and raised here, in fact. He was first introduced to the world of performance in second grade after he signed up for a summer camp led by the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. And 11 years later, he found himself a theater major with an acting concentration at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Welcome to you, Griffin.
Thank you very much.
Of course. I first have to ask the playwright, Rogelio Martinez, what was the inspiration for creating a play out of what is, all, for all intents and purposes, a memorable concert?
Well, I think the original idea, I was actually working on a different play about U.S.-China relationships, and I had my daughter on my lap, and I was writing away, and I was trying to indoctrinate her into Bruce Springsteen, and suddenly I saw that she was watching this concert, and I said, wow, East Berlin, 88, I have to write about that. And Springsteen fan, but I'm also, I grew up, I was born in Cuba, and I grew up in a household where they always said, whatever is said inside the house can't be said outside the house. Mm. And so I started thinking about East Germany, I started thinking about that period in time, and I said, this is a way to write about my childhood in a way that it's not direct. And so that got me going, and as it is with previous plays of mine, I did some research, I looked around, I saw some footage, and then started writing the play.
Mm-hmm. And so give us a synopsis of the play then. What is the story that we're going to be seeing?
It follows multiple storylines, but it's about, primarily it's about a young woman who goes to East Berlin to set up this concert. And the bureaucracy that she has to sort of navigate, and how she begins to learn about that culture and why people behave the way they do. And then several other storylines actually show you people who are living under this dictatorship, for lack of a better word.
Well, before you go on, we have to just mention the parallels with today. We've got all kinds of arts organizations and musicians and actors that are having a problem coming to this country to perform, thanks to the idiot in chief in Washington. but please, go on.
Well, no, I mean,
digress.
No, it's interesting that you mentioned today, because that's one of the things that beyond that, it's we have Facebook, we have Instagram, and one of the things that has always fascinated me is I was taught not to say things, and here we are giving away
everything.
And so I'm looking at a society where they're under constant surveillance and they're afraid. We're living in a society where we're giving it all away and saying, hey, this is who I am, and come and take it and do what you please. And I think it's scary. It's scary.
Mm-hmm. Griffin O'Connor, you're playing Gerhard
yes.
in this production. You're obviously of a different generation mm-hmm. and know and come from a very different standpoint. Mm-hmm. You grew up with the internet.
Yeah.
And that's just astonishing to me. Yeah.
Going right off of that, I've only known a society where we're so open with our information, particularly growing up in San Francisco as well, such a liberal place, such
sure.
a place where you don't have to sort of walk that line of fear and not knowing So it was really interesting, get kind of learning about this world, learning about this history gives me a better appreciation, I think, for societies around the world today that still experience this sort of governmental oppression.
I was going to say, it's not foreign to us now.
Not
we
at
look
all.
At other regimes that mm-hmm. are trying to suppress.
Yeah.
And so what was it like for you, Rogelio, growing up in Cuba? And what sort of things could you not say outside of the house?
Well, I always describe Cuba as a country that raises gossip to the level of national security. Everybody on the block, on each block in Cuba, there was a person called the Minister to Defend the Revolution. Big titles. But there was basically, they would see you come in and out. They would say, oh, this person has a bag. What's in the bag? But it's gossip, ultimately, mm-hmm. and dangerous gossip, because it can... it could get people in a lot of trouble, mm-hmm. even if there was nothing in the bag.
Mm-hmm. Take us back to 1980 when you came over on the Mariel boat lift.
Wow. It happened in late May, early June. I arrived in this country on June 2nd, I believe. And one day Castro said, anybody who wants to leave Cuba can go. And his word was gold, right? So everybody here started to rent boats and pay for spaces on the boat. And so suddenly, out of the blue, we got this call. Hey, we're coming to get you. And I wasn't told the whole truth. At the very end, my father wasn't allowed to leave. It was sort of a bunch of strange circumstances. But he wasn't allowed to leave. But I wasn't told that he wasn't coming. I was lied to because they were afraid that I would show emotion, and then they would say, well, this person doesn't want to leave. This young boy does not want to leave. But yeah, it was a time of incredible change because, as I said, I was educated in Cuba, and I was taught that this was the right way. And suddenly we arrive in this country, and my mom says, well, let me just say, everything we taught you, well, it's not true. And suddenly I had to understand a different new world. Yeah.
And so did your entire family come over on the lift?
It was just me, my mom, my grandfather, and his daughters.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And by the time the boat lift had ended, some 125,000 people had made it to Florida.
Remarkable.
It's incredible. Yeah. To think about. So, Griffin, tell us about your character, Gerhard.
So Gerhard is one of these other storylines that Rahelia mentioned. He's the youth, the people who are unwilling to accept this government. He is somebody who is incredibly brash and incredibly willing to fight for what he believes in. And his girlfriend, Katya, who is played by the wonderful Isabel Langan, She is somebody who is very tortured by this society and very sort of beaten down by this society. And he sees something in her. He sees a potential in her that is explored throughout the rest of the play. And it's sort of this relationship that we see multiple times popping up throughout the play and how the world that they live in is affecting them and how... Gerhard is unwilling to sit with that, but how little ability he has to actually change it by himself.
Mm-hmm. And the other characters that we encounter?
We have the character of Anne, who's the American, and I think every play has to have an outsider. Mm-hmm. They have to be the voice of the audience, and Anne is there and says, what's going on? Why are you this way? And that's the lesson she learns in the play. Mm-hmm. There's a Stasi officer who has a relationship ultimately that costs them a great deal. No spoilers. Let's stop there.
Okay. Well, what do you want us to get out of the play then?
Well, I want you to leave the play. I want you to go to a restaurant.
Oh, we're not going
to
stay.
No, I want you to go to a restaurant and I want you to say, hey, Something's going on in this world today mm-hmm. that play is telling us about. Mm-hmm. That play is a warning about today's world. and let's see what's going on and let's see what we're willing to give up. And because that play is showing us something, yeah. Mm.
I see history plays in your CV. Is that your focus these days as a playwright? Is that what you want to tell, stories that are based in history?
Sure. I went through a trilogy. I wanted to write a play about Nixon and going to China. And then I wrote a play about the first time Reagan met with Gorbachev. And now I wanted to write about East Berlin. Actually, East Berlin was the one that was written in the second. But, yeah, I'm fascinated by history, but I'm fascinated by the I look at history as a sort of a crowded elevator. And I'm looking at there's the main two characters. But so, for example, Reagan and Gorbachev to the left and to the right are the interesting people. And those are the ones that are pushing the story forward. So, yeah, history fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. And I should mention that you are one that doesn't keep things in stone up until the last minute. I understand there's some text changes that are happening even on opening night, leading up to opening night tonight.
I mean, theater is
a living thing for you.
Yeah, theater is a living thing, and it's a collaboration. And I always say the play belongs to me until it starts rehearsals, and then it belongs to the director and the actors. And ultimately, in the end, it belongs to the audience.
Are you able to step back?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, that's the thrill of it, is that, and you know that the play will hopefully be produced again, and each time you're going to be shown something that you didn't know was there. And that's why we do theater. It's because it's a collaborative art.
Rogelio Martinez, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about Born in East Berlin. Did Springsteen change the lyric when he sang that tune?
No, he didn't. No, he didn't.
Gerhard O'Connor is playing... Gerhard O'Connor. Griffin O'Connor.
That's happened many a time in the rehearsal process.
Is playing Gerhard in the role Griffin O'Connor.
Yep.
You can learn more about him through the website, and we can catch this at sfplayhouse.org. The performances are going to be at the Creativity Theater at the Children's Creativity Museum, 221 4th Street here in San Francisco. Opening night tonight and runs through February 29th. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Berkeley Symphony continues its season tonight with new conductor installed, Joseph Young. On the program, also vocalist Kelly Okano brings the profound words of Argentinian feminist poet Alfonsina Storni to life in Bryce Dessner's Voy a Dormir. The San Francisco Girls Chorus joins to commemorate the 19th Amendment and Voting Rights Act with Mary Kuyumidjian's powerful Become Who I Am. And the evening concludes with Brahms' Impassioned Symphony No. 1. That's at Berkeley Symphony tonight at 8 p.m. Let's go on a soothing musical note and hear a bit of the slow movement from Brahms' amazing First Symphony.
Thank you.
From Johannes Brahms' First Symphony, the slow movement that you can hear tonight as part of the Berklee Symphony's continued series under new music director, Joseph Young, berkleesymphony.org for more information. I'm David Latulippe. Next week on Open Air, you'll hear about the SpongeBob musical in town from February 12th through the 16th. We'll have SpongeBob SquarePants himself, actor Lorenzo Puglisi, to talk about that show. Also talk with actress Monique Hafen-Adams about her role in Chicago. She's going to be Roxy, fantastic musical. Also from San Jose, talk with music director and principal conductor Joseph Marcheso about their upcoming production of Il Trovatore. That and more. Next week on Open Air, a reminder that all of our shows are archived at KALW.org, including the past 2 weeks that we had to miss our live performance. Those were web exclusives. You can catch it on the Open Air tab at KALW.org. Neil Swinkles produces the show. I'm David at KALW.org if you'd like to comment or suggest a future show segment. Thanks for listening.